Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourne, and with me, as always, is Thomas Brooks.
Hello, hello.
So we've got a spicy one today.
Yeah, we do. We need all of the notices and flashes and plus 18, and we're not accusing anyone of misconduct. Please don't sue us.
Yeah, we are only reporting what other people have talked about.
Yes.
We are passing opinion of opinion.
Yes.
On this one.
Scientific analysis that we could possibly conduct.
Yeah. We're returning back to Retraction Watch and another Retraction Watch Watch. Maybe that's what we should call it. We're watching Retraction Watch.
Yes.
Has given us some interesting things to talk about kind of in our free time, and now we want to take some of like the spiciest stuff that's happened over the last, I guess, month and a half now. It's supposed to be.
About a month and a half. Like, this would be what, our March edition?
Yeah.
Of Retraction Watch Watch?
Yeah, though some of this stuff has bled into April, and the beginning of my story started the day after we recorded, or like the week after we recorded our first one. So,
yes. I guess before we get started, I do want to thank Retraction Watch for putting us in their newsletter.
Absolutely.
That was way cool.
I was scared at first.
Yeah, no, this is like the best way to get into the Retraction Watch newsletter.
Yeah, when you're one of the people talking about unethical issues and trying to highlight them. But speaking of ethics, we definitely want to throw out some warnings. This episode is going to include maybe not my story. My story's standard issue plagiarism with some other interesting stuff thrown in. But your story.
We got a couple things. So, like, the subject of my story has not been litigious as of late. So I do want to throw out a notice that we are not alleging that he has engaged in misconduct. That is something between him and the journals who have published his work. And possibly his institute. That may just be him and his mom. So that there's that. First of all, don't sue us.
There's a lot of questions. And
yes.
I mean, I would say I would love answers, but also do not contact us. We are probably not the place for you to answer questions. You can go and do it at some more, I guess, prestigious news outlet.
That is also a part of the story, is level of prestige as well on the people commenting on this story. So just be aware, this is an opinion piece, and I'm not alleging any misconduct whatsoever. The other piece that I need to, I guess, say up front is that there is an 18 plus on this episode because of the nature of this person's research, which involves zoophilia, or for those uninitiated, bestiality. We have some necrophilia in here, as well as injuries sustained due to anal fisting. So we are in the Thomas rabbit hole. Welcome to the nightmare.
I don't know if I'm ready. but I guess with that in mind, maybe we'll do mine first, and that if anyone wants to stop halfway through, they can just turn us off and not listen further.
Yes, sounds good.
So I'm going to talk about sports sciences.
So controversial.
Well, yeah. I know a lot of great exercise sports scientists. There's a lot of overlap in terms of some of like our methods, and sports psychology and like exercise sports science have a rich history together.
Mm-hmm.
But
every single one of my intro to psych students wants to do something related to sports science, concussions, and sports psychology.
Well, this is the episode for them, because that's what I'm going to talk about, concussions in sports science. Well, at least a researcher. Paul McCrory, who is one of like the preeminent researchers, and he is sort of the AFL, which I think is the Australian Football League. Yes, the Australian Football League.
So soccer.
Yes. Yeah, soccer for us Yankees. He's worked with them. And so I'll read this quote from the article. McCrory, now of the Florey Institute of Neuroscience and Mental Health in Australia. So he's a neuroscientist too, Thomas.
Ah, beautiful. What can go wrong?
Yeah, he has worked with the Australian Football League. And in fact, he was their like lead concussion researcher, or at least one of their like big people in that division to do research and kind of oversee stuff. Has developed a, quote, reputation for publicly ridiculing research that found a link between repetitive head injury and neurodegenerative disease. That was according to The Age.
So wait, he's criticizes research that links concussions to neurodegenerative disease?
He's criticized that.
Okay.
Yeah, he's been kind of critical of that work. He's very prolific, though. And he's very well known. However, there's some stuff that's come out. The British Journal of Sports Medicine, and this was first published in the end of February, has retracted an editorial. The publisher has joined the never-ending, quote, plagiarism euphemism parade. The retraction notice, which the journal embargoed until today, it says the article has been retracted due to unlawful and indefensible breach of copyright. There was significant overlap with a previous publication, Physics, Technology, and the Olympics, by Dr. Steve Hake, or Hake. I'm probably mispronouncing both. So, Retraction Watch reached out to them, and Dr. McCrory did not respond.
Mm-hmm.
However, Dr. Hake did.
Okay.
And they published him. And so I have to like quote it as much as possible. Like, and then I can talk more fluidly about the other four, like three articles on this that's come out over March. This is Steve Hockey's words. If you're allowed only six words, then I suppose the euphemism, quote, unlawful and indefensible breach of copyright captures what happened here. On the other hand, obituaries rarely say person dies, as it misses out a hell of a lot of detail. Basically, he wrote an article for Physics World called Physics, Technology, and the Olympics. The article took a long time, with sentences written and rewritten. He later found, and this was in 2000, he later found in 2005, Paul McCrory's editorial warm-up piece, The Time Lords, Measurement and Performance in Sprinting, that the opening lines were his. And that just over half the words in the articles, 50.7% to be exact, were copied and pasted. Even then, the carefully crafted final sentence, quote, a century on from Baron de Coubertin's original vision of the Olympics, the motto swifter, higher, stronger, ultimately still depends on the skill of the athlete. Written originally in the year 2000 by Dr. Steve Hake, exact in the 2005 Paul McCrory.
Damn.
Incidentally, he found that Paul was the editor-in-chief of the British Journal of Sports Medicine at the time, and he had written another warm-up piece called Fraud and Misconduct in Publication. So Steve kind of argues that he obviously knows right from wrong because he wrote a piece on fraud and publication. I love this quote. It's not as though Paul didn't know right from wrong, or that the word plagiarism means from the Greek for kidnapping. Oh, and so the retracted paper still exists on his ResearchGate page and has three citations. Okay. One of the citations was a publication by his own research lab. People who had been Steve's PhD students cited the McCrory article where he stole half of his words.
Damn.
And this isn't like I don't even have to say like we're making accusations here or like hey, we're just like these are the facts.
Uh-huh.
Half of the words were identical. Like, damn. It's not like a paraphrasing issue. So apparently a decade went by before they didn't do it. They did something about it. It wasn't until June 2021. He had to deal with an issue of self-plagiarism. Ugh. That he reached back to them. And this showed me that something could actually be done about plagiarism. And 2 days later, he wrote to BJSM. And they noted very quickly, well, there is significant overlap between these two. And obviously, one was published 5 years before the other. And he's like, am I satisfied? No. He was, at the time, still associate editor of the Clinical Journal of Sports Medicine, but that has changed. He has 530 journal articles, 55 letters. He is assistant professor, Paul McCrory, MBBS, PhD, FRACP, FACSP, FFSEM, FASMF, FACSM, FRSM, grad dip, ped biostats. That's his full title. I'm not sure. I know what PhD means.
Right. No, well, and I think one of the implications here, and this is something that I learned recently, is that the more when you're in a consulting or mental health kind of situation that's dealing with health insurance, at least in the United States,
yeah,
the more titles you have at the end of your name, the more you can charge insurance.
Wow.
So that's okay. Directly tied to income, at least here in the States. I don't know how it is in Australia, obviously, yeah. But the more you have, the more you can charge.
Yeah. So he's a so you've got this issue of a professor. He's professor of sports engineering and the director of engagement at Advanced Wellbeing Research Center at Sheffield Hallam University. Highly critical. Like this is sort of like, you know what? I'm really angry that this happened. And like this letter, like I will link it. Everyone needs to read what he wrote. Like that is the response that you give to someone. And I think he was very nice in his response. There's no cursing. There's no, maybe there was, he carefully crafted it.
We don't know which draft this is.
Yeah. This is definitely a final draft. But it's amazing that like it was so blatant. And of course, like Retraction Watch has reached out. We haven't heard anything from Dr. McCrory. So not long after that, 3 days later, was leading sports medicine researchers plagiarism, quote, an isolated and unfortunate incident. Because that's his response to this. Dr. McCrory reaches out. And says that it was, quote, an isolated and unfortunate incident that resulted from the uploading to the journal's website of a working draft that failed to appropriately cite your original and excellent work as a source of the manuscript. So basically what he's saying is that, you know, he's got 530 publications in 20 years. That's a lot. Like if I'm going back to 2005. Mm-hmm. So like even from there, I'll say since 2000, he's done, what, 530 divided by 20? Like, that's still, that's how many publications a year?
Yeah.
That's a lot. So he's very prolific. He's putting stuff together. Maybe you copy and paste some stuff in, like, to a note page, and then you go back and clean up the language afterwards. But, like, 50.7%? Oh, no. I'm a little...
Right, no, that's like my... intro student's excuse is like, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to put quotes. And I'm like, where were you going to put the quotes? Around the whole damn article?
Exactly. Well, I was like, you know, when you quote more than five lines of text, you have to put it in a block format.
So what kind of formatting should you have done for this? That would have been ridiculous.
Nick Brown, who's one of Retraction Watch's data sleuths, who we should probably reach out to and maybe try to talk to in the future.
Uh-huh.
Has decided to do his own digging to deal with this quote, isolated and unfortunate incident. Brown found two more papers very quickly from British Journal of Sports Medicine that appeared to contain, quote, widespread plagiarism.
Mm. While he's editor in chief?
Well, there's a new editor in chief.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, this was like a former editor at one point. Yeah. So, as I quote, this is the quote from the letter he sent to the current editor in chief. It took me very little time to identify two other pieces by the same author that also appeared to be extensively plagiarized. McCrory, Definitions of the Purist, British Journal of Sports Medicine, 2005. McCrory, Take Nothing But Pictures, Leave Nothing But Footprints, British Journal of Sports Medicine, 2006. Between 80 and 90% of the text has been copied essentially verbatim from other sources without appropriate citation or attribution. Brown attached PDFs for comparison, so he basically pulled the receipts so that it was hard to say otherwise, and goes on to note that McCrory's name shows up in some 200 articles in the BJSM. And so he says, I think Nick Brown definitely does not have the time to go through everything this guy has done, but said that like maybe an editor, like a junior editor, someone editorial assistant at BGSM should start going through this. That he's only spent 2 hours looking at his papers and found this. Who knows? What else is there? Yeah, and at that point, this was 3 days later. This story was published in Retraction Watch. So it's like, this is all happening very rapidly. And then 2 days later, Paul McCrory actually comes out and requests another retraction himself. These two cases, let's see. McCrory called the plagiarism isolated, but Nick Brown found at least two similar cases. Of those two cases, McCrory, who has served as an Australian Football League consultant, now says, that the first one in 2005 must have been uploaded, like kind of said it was the same thing. Like it was meant, it was a draft. It was uploaded at the same time. That's really, like, there's so much work that goes into, I mean, this was an editorial, I guess, but like, there's so much work that goes into publishing. Like, how do you not know you're not uploading the right paper? But I don't know. Like, 2005 is a different, you know, different year than 2015 or 2020, but not much has changed. Journal websites. Basically says in both cases the errors were not deliberate or intentional, but nevertheless require redress. As for what has been published is plagiarism, it admits, like, he's like, yeah, but we screwed up, or I screwed up. It needs to be retracted. Both of them need to be retracted. And he apologizes. He also tells us that he tells Retraction Watch that it was him who requested the retraction of that edit, the original editorial. Like, he reached out and said, yep, pull it. Like, mistake was made. I mean, he's got, you know, and in no way does any explanation suffice to explain this mistake, which is kind of right there. No explanation really helps. He says that,
the less you say, the better.
Yeah, but he says a lot here. This is a lot here. I'll read some bits and pieces. But in the mid-2000s, as editor, I wrote a series of warm-up pieces for the journal. It was a monthly column designed to pick up on sports medicine papers of interest. And so what he's kind of sounds to be claiming is that, like, he was meant to, like, highlight these articles and highlight articles that do exist on these topics, but instead kind of wrote it as his own words, or at least it was presented because it wasn't cited or attributed properly. Yeah, he says, I have now found out that what was uploaded was an early working draft. Like, but he was an editor at BGSM when they were uploaded.
Right. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, like, not to give him an excuse, but I have had preprints of, like, drafts of articles that, like, pre-peer review.
Yeah.
So, like, the editor took one of the older drafts after the peer review process, before the peer review process, and did that as the preprint instead of the one post peer review.
Yeah.
So, like, mistakes can be made. Like, you got to, like, check your preprints, like, always to make sure that they did do the right draft. But, like, if he was the editor...
Yeah. Yeah, at the same time that this apology came out on Twitter, James Heathers, who's he's a friend of Nick Brown. There, he's another sleuth that kind of does some like research sleuthing. He's like, this was bugging me, and I had a minute. I won't do this as neatly as Nick Brown here, but these check out. He found 1, 2, 3. He's got a whole Twitter thread of other examples with other things of like plagiarism, like the three criteria for plagiarism. He says, these examples, here's some, are these the end of the world? These criteria for plagiarism are one, identical, or the three criteria of plagiarism are identical text to earlier work by external authors. And that seems like it's met here. It isn't good. It's identical text by people who had previously written the same exact thing. And I mean, like he makes a normal point, like senior academics often make their fair chunk of their enormous like X hundred article portfolios, where you just kind of put a bunch of articles and like you might type some stuff up and like have some notes together, but like he was able to find some egregious stuff in hours.
I also wonder too, like, how much of this was first author, like legitimately first author written by him, and how much of it is like students in his lab. Because like there's another layer of like institutional like problems here. Like on one hand, the journal should have been checking this before it was published, but on the other hand, there is an issue of senior academics like stealing the work of their like students, both graduate students and undergraduate students, and then putting themselves as first author. And so I also wonder if this is like written by an undergraduate who didn't know better, and then he's claiming first authorship, and now he can't back out of claiming first authorship because he has to like take responsibility for it now.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, because that'd be like a tough bind to find yourself in, because this whole time, like, it's been all your first author papers, and if you've been like taking the work of your grad students and stuff like that to do some quick publishing for these like monthly these little monthly mini articles,
right?
Yeah, because then at that point, if you admit to doing that, that's even worse. Like, I mean, it's bad, but no, it's worse.
It is worse. It's definitely worse.
I was like, yeah, plagiarism's bad. I was like, is it like equal? I'm like, no, it's not just plagiarism, but it'd be like directly stealing the work from your students, which it's like plagiarism on another level. It would literal article kidnapping.
Not that I'm saying he did that.
Right.
But this was the early 2000s, and these students wouldn't have had Twitter to bitch and complain about it. So
yeah, it's definitely true. I mean, even students today that might deal with that aren't necessarily going to go on Twitter and do it.
Right. They're going to, if they do it, they'll do it after they graduate.
Right. Right. Yeah. Cause you don't want to lose that position in the lab. There's a lot of,
you don't want to risk like paying all this money and time and then not getting your PhD because your supervisor won't sign it because you're back. Like, he stole your work and then you called him out on it. And now he's bitter. So this is a fantasy speculation that has no bearings on real life events.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll put a link to this fourth article because it doesn't involve McCrory specifically, but it does involve the Australian Football League and a $60,000 grant to do concussion research on retired athletes, that this one researcher who got the grant, Associate Professor Alan Pierce, who ended up having to like leave his lab because of some issues with like them not communicating with him, not giving him access to the athletes, not funding his research. Apparently, McCrory, who was part of the AFL as like their big like lead concussion researcher, had come in and he was their senior advisor on concussion, and a neurologist contacted him to meet. Part of what he wanted to talk to me about, Pierce says, was the funding he received. Although he was AFL's concussion expert, he had nothing to do with my study, apparently. And Pierce felt that McCrory was trying to tell him what he could and couldn't do with respect to the research. They did like an ABC, so like one of their news stations reports on his research. It was apparently signed off on, but then they were like, who gave you permission to do that and to talk about your research? And it kind of just died. Like they didn't really communicate. They kept coming to him and saying like, hey, we need all of this. We need like the data. I thought you were going to be doing studies on like these retired athletes. And he was like, you won't let me do more than cursory examinations. I can't do a full study without these more in-depth examinations. And it was kind of weird. And so it kind of talks about like the 2015, 2016 juggling with his research, and how McCrory's a part of it because he was concussion consultant. Pierce is just sort of like, you know, with just 6 months to go before funding ran out, he was finally sent the list of 40 players to contact. He said many of their email addresses bounced back. He only had enough funding and resources to perform tests on one player a week. So by the time funding for the study ended, he had assessed just 8.
Damn.
Yeah, like it's a whole mess with like funding and whatnot. And so, yeah, like the AFL has not responded. Some questions from the Guardian Australia. Yeah, their note is it says past AFL players were encouraged to participate in his study funded by the AFL, but regrettably they largely chose not to, preferring to focus on clinical care. Yeah. They said there was going to be like a following 2-year contract period. Pierce said he didn't know anything about a further 2-year contract period. But it seems like there's a lot of he said, she said stuff. Mm-hmm. As part of it, but it's another really interesting if it's a lot longer of a read from the Guardian Australia that deals with some of the stuff, and yeah, again, like there's some other stuff, like a new investigation has been launched by the regulator into allegations against McCrory, but it could not provide more details because he may have breached his undertaking, because apparently as part of this McCrory met with him and was like, you gotta do this and this in your study. Like, this is how the study's gotta go. And he's like, but I'm already doing the study. What do you mean change it now? It's an interesting, you know, I guess big business funded research. I don't know, we could probably call the Australian Football League big business. a lot of money. Be like saying the National Football League in the United States, you know, for American right. football was yeah. small business. No. Yeah, really interesting. So it's wild. Like, it seems that I don't know. And again, like, I'd love to know, but you know, you're asking a researcher, like, what were you doing 15 years ago, 17 years ago when you published this paper?
Shoot, I don't even know what I was doing like 3 weeks ago.
Right?
Oh, right, I was Prairie Fiesta.
So, like, whew. But, like, that's the process sometimes. And, like, the guy knew, like, noticed it. Dr. Hake noticed it early on, but like apparently like had run into walls until later when like he realized like, oh, articles, like we can do stuff about this, we can make corrections, we can be a little more forceful in like fighting against it. And it's wild.
It may also be like a shift in the digital, right? Because like if you came up in like the 20th century doing research, like when it was published,
right Right. Yeah. Like, who do you contact?
Right.
Even in like all physical, early 2000s. Yeah.
Yeah. But now it's like things can go up, they can go down, corrections can be made. Yeah. Like, journals are getting on board with the fluidity of publication.
Yeah. So it's fascinating. I'm expecting more in the future. Yes. This may be the tip of the iceberg, because it seems like this, and the people looking into some of the research, like, whew, it's definitely looks like there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I'm sure this is a, like, the scratch is gonna like reveal a mass grave.
Yeah.
So yeah, that'll be fun to keep an eye out on.
Yeah, with very little research, two sleuths of like 5 more papers. So.
Right.
And that was like a couple of days after. So, like, who knows what's going to come out of this. So,
Well, my suggestion to Retraction Watch, contact past students.
Ooh. Yeah, that could be. Oh, man.
See what's going on. What's that publication process like? Huh. Interesting.
So, yeah, there's a bit of controversy. But I don't think anywhere near. So at this point.
Yeah, if you're going to bail out now.
This is the point to do it. Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome to Thomas's sex class.
Yeah, you can skip the bias of the week. Have a good one. It's nice knowing you. I'm going to start playing the outro now. All right, and we're back. There we go.
So this is the most wild, sensational, international fake celebrity story that I have ever read. So this is the story of Damien Sindler. And there was he calls it a hit piece. I'm probably going to call it a hit piece too, but in the journalist's defense, she did sit down, or he did sit down with Damien, and they actually, like, they confronted them about, like, a lot of weird questions about his research and stuff like that. That this is something that we can link. It's from Gizmodo,
yeah.
Tech, Science, Culture by Jennings Brown. And it's entitled "The Fake Sex Doctor Who Conned the Media into Publicizing His Bizarre Research on Suicide, Butt Fisting, and Bestiality."
I mean, I guess you could say it's a hit piece in the same vein as, like, if I've been accused of a bunch of stuff and someone, like, got me to sit down and be like, we need to talk about all the stuff you've been accused of, and we're going to report on it. It reminds me of that guy, we'll have to talk about him at one point, who got busted, one of the early Reddit mods who got busted. Some journalist found out who he was and was like, hey, I just want to give you a heads up. I'm going to publish who you are, because you're a terrible person and you've been posting all this really inflammatory, racist, anti-Semitic, jailbaity stuff online. And like, and he was like, no, you can't do it. Like, I could lose my job. And he's like, why didn't you think about that when you were posting anything? Like, it was, didn't deny any of the stuff that he had done. It was just sort of like, I've been caught.
So this goes beyond Reddit. So this guy, just in terms of public consciousness and conversation, he's been published. He has a full, like, character piece on Vice. He's been in Men's Health. He's been interviewed on Savage Lovecast, so Dan Savage's podcast. He's been featured in Playboy, Insider, Forbes. Like, he's been around the block. Like, if anybody follows, like, sensational sex research journalism, this name is probably familiar. And so the original piece that interviewed him and, like, started questioning what's going on here was done in 2019. And at this point, there were really no publication research controversies that had erupted by any means. This is like independent journalism sleuthing kind of stuff, right?
So like at this point, is it like this guy has, like, maybe published some hot takes and, like, maybe
he's published some,
or has there been, like, an academic, like, has he had academic publications at this point?
Yes, he has both academic publications, and he's translating those into to lay audiences.
Okay.
Which brings questions and magnifying glasses upon us all, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So
it'd be easy just to publish some stuff and no one knows about it. But you're publishing clickbaity stuff.
Yes.
Controversial stuff. Yes. And then you're getting wide recognition for it. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. So he kind of like dug his own grave here, and he was just standing on the edge waiting for someone to push him in. And so this journalist did the interview, and their take, Jennings, was that he's a serial fabulist, is what they called him. The accomplished doctor character of Sindler has created an appearance in numerous media outlets, blah, 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 blah. Many of these platforms have published Sindler's lies and publicized his bizarre and irresponsible studies on necrophilia, zoophilia, lethal erotic asphyxiation, and sexual assault. Until recently, he was soliciting patients through his website, where he offered online psychotherapy and sex therapy. His website states he's one of the youngest elected members of the American Psychiatric Association and the American Academy of Psychiatry and the Law, and that Barack Obama gave him a President's Gold Service Award for his contributions in medicine and mental health. He also claims he has both a PhD and an MD from Harvard.
Okay.
None of these things have any paper trail whatsoever.
So never a Harvard student, it seems? Not a noted member of the APA?
That is, so he was a member of the APA.
Okay.
I don't know if he still is.
Okay.
But when the journalist reached out and asked about information like, hey, is this a member? Was this an elected person within like the leadership bureaucracy? They were like, well, they're not elected, but they are a member because they have an MD. And then the reporter was like, okay, so have y'all confirmed the MD? And they were like, well, it's on its website.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And all of these links to the website and different pages and stuff are all dead now.
So like, basically, it's like saying if someone reached out, and like if I said I was a member of the APA,
mm-hmm.
and I reached out, the APA would probably say, well, he's a member of the American Psychological Association because he has a PhD in psychology.
So this is psychiatry, so he has to have an MD.
Right. But I mean, kind of in a similar fashion. Like, I abide by the rules of the APA because we do so on so many levels that, but I also wouldn't call myself a member because I'm not a dues paying member of the APA because they're really expensive.
Right. So apparently he's like an elected like person, according to him, or back in 2019, he was claiming this, and then there wasn't a paper trail. There is evidence that he was in a master's of like liberal arts general studies at Harvard, or like the Harvard branch, but not at Harvard. And then he worked in a research lab at Harvard while he wasn't a student as a research assistant, but claimed that the person he worked for was his graduate advisor that got him graduated, which then wasn't corroborated by the researcher in charge of the lab. So lots of like very fantastic claims from this dude and no receipts.
This is one of those things though that like I think about like the litigious aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to bring someone, like for one, maybe you could argue that this is a public figure. He's pretty out there, but also right. like it kind of blurs the line with academics, but in this case like it would either be an open and shut case, but like he can't bring this case to court without allowing for like a collection of evidence. And right. so
like in terms of like suing us for talking about him in a
I'm thinking about anyone like, right. like I mean because like a lot of the people writing about him you said are like we're just reporting what was said by other people. Like there's this like litigious.
Yeah, these are questions here. I personally have. This is right. not an allegation. Right.
Right. Yeah. Once discovery is made in a court case, like that would be something like Well, it's like there's this recent, like the recent case where I think it's like what, like Trump is suing for like people who claim that he was a Russian asset, and like, but by suing, like discovery opens up. So like, if there's any proof or they have any documents, like lawyers are going to get their hands on that. They have to, or the case is going to get thrown out. It's going to be a waste of time, which could be what it is. Becomes like a slap suit or something like that. We need to get a lawyer on and talk to a lawyer about like defamation and like science cases. That'd be fun.
So we've got this weird bubbling around this dude. He gets his hit piece in 2019. Another piece comes out. Let's see. This is from Science Integrity Digest, which is a blog by, let's see, Elizabeth Bick.
Elizabeth Bick's a big name in research sleuthing.
So he's on her radar as well, or at least in 2019.
Yeah.
And this is before the retraction. And she draws attention to his affiliations, particularly his present affiliations. So he has two of them. So the first one is the Medical University of Lublin in Poland.
Okay.
He apparently spent time in Poland, and I think there was, no, they could not confirm that he was a student there. But that appears, his typical co-author does have an affiliation there. And then the really interesting part is that the second affiliation is the Felnet Health Research Foundation, which does not have a website and only comes up in search results about Damien's articles because it's getting picked up in the affiliation on the papers. There used to be information on his personal webpage about this affiliation. It's no longer there. But the Institute's addresses, I guess, that were present on the website were to a condo in New York and a house in a Polish village. And there is reason to suspect that it's a fictitious institution because the only person that can be confirmed as a employee there is his mother. Even though the Institute has multiple departments. And this is according to this article by Bick.
Yeah.
Yes. And this institute and the university in Poland come up in just about all of his publications, right? And so this lays the groundwork for the retraction. So he made it on Retraction Watch last month because of his paper about zoophilia. I'll read you the abstract. I think I am of two minds about this study. I think on one hand, it's a very useful, it could have been a great study. Let's put it that way.
Everything's called into question about it then, right?
Mm-hmm. On one hand, I'm like, damn, I wish this was like a legit study because I currently have a student right now doing her term paper over zoophilia, and this would have been perfect for her paper. On the other hand, I'm like, well, it looks like you made up an institute in your New York condo. So
what else did you make up? Yeah. I would want to see the data now.
Mm-hmm. So this paper is entitled, let's see, Digital Ethnography of Zoophilia, a Multinational Mixed Methods Study by Sindler and his colleague, Lou Starowick? Michael Lou Starowick, who is at the Polish Institute. And this is in the Journal of Sex and Marital Therapy. And it was published in 2019. And the abstract is, quote, this study investigates people who have sex with animals by describing their living situation, sexual activity, beliefs, and attitudes towards stigmatization. These data are highly applicable to the work of psychiatric and forensic professionals investigating paraphilias. We apply a mixed method approach using qualitative and quantitative analyses. The findings come from anonymous forum postings of 953 participants, of which 345 agreed to complete a survey upon advertising the study. We identify several themes describing concerns of zoosexuals chatting within online communities, living situation, sex life, social acceptability, getting help. First, we provide data on how people who have sex with animals justify their relationship with animal sex partners, with particular emphasis on sex practices and physical features most attractive to them. Second, we elaborate on the stigma associated with being a zoosexual, including the coping mechanisms for dealing with social ostracism. Third, we elaborate on in detail as to why people who have sex with animals find animals sexually appealing. Lastly, we present evidence that online discussion spaces serve as the platform for help-seeking behavior for individuals with paraphilias. This study presents the largest analysis of zoophiles in modern history, using mixed method approaches, uncovering their daily activities, sexual preferences, and help-seeking behaviors. So that would have been the most beautiful study.
But yeah, I say as an outsider, if I were sitting on that journal's, if I were one of the people asked to review that paper, yeah, absolutely. It sounds like it's exactly what we want. We want a deep dive. We want to understand. And then there's this argument that these online groups are helping them move towards the path of getting help,
possibly treatment, or I don't know if like people on Zoof, honestly, like,
I don't know.
Just from my human sexuality experience and research, I don't know if they're...
You're not trolling. You're not
I don't know if they're acknowledging that they have paraphilias. I think there's a lot of depathologicalization going on in those forums.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, that would make me question it a little bit, because like, I know what a lot of online spaces look like nowadays. I don't know what those online spaces look like. But a lot of online spaces for very niche communities are usually there to stroke the community's ego. They're there. Yes. They're there to reinforce community behavior, not to really as a means. I mean, it makes me think of like the pro ANA communities,
right?
That they might argue otherwise, and there are online help communities, but that's not like they finally started talking about that in intro textbooks, because like, there's enough research now to be like, no, these communities are causing more harm.
Right. Yeah. Like, when in doubt, the internet's a bad place. Just assume the worst, and it's probably like four more levels.
Especially when you're delving into like highly stigmatized communities that are engaging and kind of working in the shadows, essentially. You know, it's like a 4chan community. You don't go to 4chan and be like, these internet trolls on 4chan are using this as a coping mechanism to get help. But I'm like, no, they're not. They're posting all sorts of...
to get worse.
Right, exactly. Exactly. They're, yeah.
So that is... And like, I don't know. I feel like with... I don't know. This is probably my spicy take, and I'll like soften it a little bit. But I think there are conversations to be had.
Yeah.
It's kind of similar to our like MAPS situation of online communities destigmatizing themselves. I think there's definitely extended conversations to be had. And like our previous guest or second previous guest, I think it deserves a cold take.
Yeah, I mean, we should have conversations about the stuff that we're uncomfortable talking about, because otherwise we're not going to be able to get research done on it. We're not going to be able to help anyone who might be dealing with issues regarding like severe paraphilias. If so we're afraid to talk about it. Yeah.
Right. So I have a cold take. I will adopt Kelly Baker's language, and I have a cold take policy on zoophilia.
Yeah.
So beautiful publication. Now the problem comes in, and this is why it was retracted, is that the subjects and the institution involved seems to have been misled about the affiliation of the researchers. Now, we don't have specifics. So the institution could be the Polish institution and this New York institution, scare quotes, or because this person has a history of claiming to have degrees from other places and be affiliated with other places, those ethics paperwork could have been something else. We don't know. The journal does not enlighten us. The journal says that the institutions listed in the ethics approval application form and the informed consent forms provided to participants had incorrect information presented to participants. Taylor and Francis will be retracting this paper on the basis that proper ethical approval was not granted to conduct this research. We have been informed in our decision-making by our policy on publishing ethics and integrity and the COPE guidelines on retractions. The retraction article will remain online to maintain the scholarly record, but will be digitally watermarked on each page as retracted. So you can pull up this paper and read it. It just has in big red letters watermarked across it, retracted on every page. And this goes back to the BIC article, because she is concerned about the ethical approval back in 2019, because there seems, so if he had used his institution in New York, and the only people we can confirm that work there are him and his mom.
It's like, Thomas, like, you know that study we've been talking about? Why don't we just create our own institution?
Right? And we like, I didn't know it was this easy.
We will approve the IRB ethics approval. Like, we will create our own IRB board.
And we'll do it right, too. Like, we'll have, like, actual people.
Us. And yeah, then we can do whatever we want. Like, right.
And then some community member who's in on it. Like,
yeah, so, exactly.
But I don't think he went that far. Okay. If he used his New York institution to approve, quote unquote, approve this. We don't know. The journal doesn't tell us who the approving institution is. Yeah,
we'd have to see that. We'd have to see that that informed consent.
Right. Yeah. Which we don't have access to yet unless... Yeah. Retraction Watch gives us an update. So this is why he is present in this, because of this retraction, but it has also reignited this past work done on him from 2019 and brought that in, which is why I think he's scrubbed his website, because there's like nothing but blog posts on there now.
So the website, like if you use like the Wayback Machine or something like that, like the website not that long ago was full.
Yes.
And it's now, only very recently that it's been scrubbed.
I need to use the Wayback Machine, but I do know it's scrubbed because the links that the Jennings used in the 2019 article, if you click on it, then they're dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it has been scrubbed. I don't know when. It could have been scrubbed after 2019, or it was scrubbed this last month. I'm not sure. So I won't make a claim about that.
Right.
Damien Sindler decide to talk to Retraction Watch. Cool. Unfortunately for him.
Oh, not cool.
So his comments are, quote, "There's nothing wrong with the research or the analysis of the collected data. The findings are novel, cited, and have already been replicated in several studies." If you check Google Scholar, they have not in fact been replicated. Unfortunately, the supervising institutions decide that they could no longer support zoophilia, paraphilia research, or any related controversial topic, which could be that the Polish institution backed out, or that his mom didn't like it because she's the IRB in New York. I don't know. Studies on paraphilias frequently generate negative publicity, which distracts from scientific endeavors in other fields. I understand the rationale and respect the decision. As a result, nothing else can be done to save this work without it being retracted. The takeaway from this experience is that research on sexuality is still highly controversial and divisive.
How about this? I'll make a deal. I don't think this guy will ever listen to us.
No.
But if he does, he can send me the data and the code book. I'll replicate his study form.
And the informed consent.
Yeah, send me that.
We won't publish the informed consent, but we are curious.
I'll try to replicate the study as an independent outsider. I do not do sex research. And so...
We should contact him and see if he would like a replication.
I'll put you as an author on the paper.
Oh, thanks. Do you want to go?
No, I meant the guy. Like, I mean, yeah, you can be
an author him. Too, oh, I was like, are help. You going to go through the zoophilia boards?
Absolutely not. That's why you're going to join me. I've already done my deep dive into controversial message boards on the internet once before.
Yes. No, it's,
I'm not doing it again.
I've dipped my toes. I found some podcasts. The podcasts are wild because some of them talk very explicitly and candidly about mutual friends of ours who do destigmatizing research. And it's brutal. And I was like, oh, damn. So, no, I've been on a little bit of a ride. Yeah. So, all that to say is he's hiding behind the stigma of sex researchers. Which is a thing, but that's like so cheap because that has nothing to do with why the paper was retracted.
Right.
Now, I mean, maybe it could be, maybe this university in Poland was like, this is inappropriate. Like
but we're also, not going to be involved with this. Absolutely not. You tell
that after you've already approved the IRB.
Well, but you could have a professor in Poland. You could have a professor in Poland who's now bringing stigma onto the university, and the university basically tells them, like, you need to request that this gets retracted.
Right.
Like, you're a co-author on this, you need to kill this or your job's in jeopardy. Like, who knows? Like, there, I mean, I'm thinking of, I don't want to defend anyone in this situation because it all sounds weird and shady, but
right. No, it's the wildest thing. So at best, he's telling the truth about the institution
about the IRB
after it's already been published. I don't know this. He is not known for his receipts, and so I don't know.
Yeah, it's just,
I don't know hard to trust it. I don't know what the journal found, so there is a benefit of a doubt, but this individual has been gallivanting across the globe, claiming lots of sensational things about him that tend to not collect appropriate amounts of evidence to instill a sense of public trustworthiness. We'll say that.
This is a pretty good argument why data should be shared.
Uh-huh.
Because if that data were on the books, we wouldn't be calling it into question.
Right. Yeah. No, it's
but
yeah, and his general takeaway, like, they went through and had a long conversation with him. He says every other negative article you find about me online is written by a blogger, so journalism, it seems, is a profession anyone can claim to practice. That is a dangerous precedent for launching smear campaigns, which are becoming more common. Even Retraction Watch is a blog, and you can agree with me that that's not exactly a media source. And then they unfortunately went did a back-to-back of, like, the narrator, the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and other media outlets disagree, as do we.
Yeah.
And he's but I'm like, you didn't have to say it. Like, okay, whatever. So they had their little catty back and forth, which was entertaining, but ultimately cringe.
Yeah. I mean, but also someone who has been accused of being just claiming they're a bunch of stuff, being like, well, it seems that anyone can call themselves a journalist nowadays. I'm like, well, anyone can call themselves a doctor, apparently. Right? I think he does seem to fit that category, especially if he's not showing his credentials, of someone who I warn my students about when I talk about, like, who calls themselves a therapist versus a licensed therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Is that in a lot of states, you can call yourself a therapist with no repercussion, but you can't call yourself a licensed therapist without actually having a license to back it up. And I tell them, if you're concerned, like, if you find someone online or you find someone who might offer you therapeutic services, ask to see licensure. And if they won't give it to you, run. It's much in the same way that, like, if someone asked me, like, can you prove that you have a PhD? Absolutely. I will produce my transcripts, and I will go pull my PhD off the wall and show it to you in person, because
I'm not going to show my transcripts because my social security number's on there, but I will show them the degree.
Yeah. I'm like,
write a letter to Taboo C.
I will give you a list of names that can confirm professors whose classes I have passed, programs, directors, department heads, deans who can clarify that like I will go out of my way to show you that I've done that, because I busted my butt to do it. I'm not going to be cagey about it.
Right. So that is my story. He's got a whole slew of crazy stuff. And, you know, if I did not have the sense of dread because of these like receipt hunts that come up bare, I think it's a very cool and very helpful area of research. So if somebody wants to do what he does, but better and above board, like, I'm all for it. Contact me. Let me know.
Yeah, there's definitely, like, I love the term heuristic value. It's my favorite psych phrase. And I think even if everything about this is false, there's good heuristic value in it.
Yes.
I mean, there's good heuristic value in a lot of pseudoscience. But definitely someone probably needs to be doing research on this. It's tough. It's tougher than more quote-unquote mainstream research. But definitely.
Yeah, it's what unloved groups in sociology, or what is it called? Basically, you're going to run into problems like every step of the way.
Because no one wants to think about those groups.
Yep.
And it makes them uncomfortable because it violates so many social norms. And so
the thought of having to like sign your name on pieces of paper with those words on that paper sends people running.
But like, you have to find people who are established who'd be willing to do that, though.
Mm-hmm.
And so that might be the key. So contact Thomas.
No, I don't see why I shouldn't just like do the replication without his I can just run a conceptual replication. Like, why not?
Right. I mean,
we need some above board data about this.
Right. And either on one hand, he applauds you because you've helped prove his points.
Not after this podcast episode.
Well, or you find that it doesn't work, and what is he going to say? He's had retractions done. He's been discredited.
Right. No, I just, well, retraction, although retraction, I anticipate similar to your Australian researcher,
Floodgates.
I would not be surprised to see a April update about our dear friend here.
And we'll do both. We'll, you know, when we come back sometime next month, and we talk a little bit about what happened in April. Let's see if there's any updates on this, and then the Macquarie research, and we'll see what's there.
So that is that's my story of trauma and tribulations of the poor, persecuted, sensationalized sex researcher, quote unquote.
With retractions in mind. I might have the perfect bias of the week.
Huzzah!
So this is Johnson and Seifert, 1994. Continued influence effect.
Ooh.
The tendency to believe previously learned misinformation even after it's been corrected.
Damn.
Been holding on to this one.
Yeah, that's a brutal bias, because you know, because like we even fell prey to that
absolutely
this semester with one of our biases of the week that had been drawn into question whether or not it's a thing or not. Like,
yeah, I mean, you could argue all this stuff, like, is we're either replicating it or we're not, and if we're not replicating it, it's a problem. And again, if you're famous,
big problem.
Like, what happens after you find out that there's problems with the Stanford Prison Study?
Right. Yeah, you've got some work to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Something to think on.
Something to think on. Does this bias? This bias assumes that I know the information is now considered false, but I'm still using it.
It's been corrected. But I think it kind of gets to the cognitive point that the memory of the original, the misinformation is still there.
Mm-hmm.
And very possibly has been reinforced and established in your memory better than the corrected information. Like, you just think of like how like a news station does something. So let's say local news station reports something about a local person and it's factually incorrect, but everyone in town hears about it.
Right.
And then the next day they come across, so they've had a day to gossip about it, to talk about it, to have it just ingrain itself in their memory. And then the next day they come out and say, like, guys, like, this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the correct. Or you take a prominent individual who makes a bunch of just ad nauseum misinformative statements, and you have people correcting those statements, but like, when do you finally get those corrections?
Right.
When do you finally learn otherwise? And if it's been a while, or if the journalist has been discredited, because anyone can call themselves a journalist, then it's that newer information is harder to supersede it.
Right. So the angels have sung because Tara Brabazon has started her new vlog series. And the one I listened to that came out today, because we're recording on a Friday, was about how things that are fast get priority and are assumed to be more truthful than things that are slow.
Absolutely.
And so I've already been sitting in that, like,
yeah.
If it comes across real fast, if you're the first person to say it blows up, the cold take is not going to get processed.
Yeah, I mean, that's like Kahneman thinking fast and slow 101. That's heuristic mm-hmm. thought gets processed almost immediately. Analytic thought, we don't got time for that.
Mm-hmm.
So the heuristic stuff makes it in, and by the time we like learn the cold take, the nuanced take, mm-hmm. the carefully constructed take, it's too late. Mm-hmm. So damn. Yeah,
well, on that uplifting note,
yeah,
this has been Retraction watch.
We'll call it something else. We'll come up with something spicy. I don't know.
Maybe we need like a chili pepper rating system for our retraction stories.
I'd probably give mine like maybe like a two. It'd have to be a one.
Actually,
like he comes out and says like he apologizes, but also like they keep finding new stuff. So maybe
our rating system is red, green, and then Christmas.
For the New Mexico route. I mean, like, but what's hotter? Because, like, I've come across green that's like, eh. And then I've come across green that, like, puts me down.
I would say that Christmas is hotter just by principle of mixing the two, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, that's not how it works here, but, like.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to say mine's a green.
I think yours is a green. Mine's Christmas.
Definitely. Yours is, like, yours is like double Christmas with extra on the side. Like,
yes. Mine is, they didn't make the meal right, so they just got me a bowl of chili, and they just dropped the thing into the chili to hide their sins.
That's a little too real. So, on that spicy food take.
Yes.
Good night, everyone. Goodbye.